We've got the Academy Awards, the Emmys, and Grammys. But what should we call the award for the most extraordinary performance by a corporate profiteer? How about the Sleazy, with winners getting a solid gold sculpture of a middle finger? There were so many worthy contenders, but one corporation exhibited uncommon callousness, so the 2021 Sleazy goes to Tyson Foods. The meatpacking giant has regularly run roughshod over workers, farmers, communities, and the environment, not to mention the millions of animals it fattens and slaughters. But the coronavirus pulled out the worst in Tyson's corporate ethic. Last April, its billionaire chair, John Tyson, ranted that health officials who were closing down several of his slaughterhouses that had become hotbeds of contagion were creating another crisis, a national meat shortage. Responding instantly, our corporate compassionate, burger-gobbling president decreed that meatpacking plants were crucial to America's national security and must be kept open at all cost. Trump's edict required workers to return to their jobs or be fired. Only, there was no meat shortage. Indeed, Tyson and other giants actually increased their meat exports to China last year. Meanwhile, COVID rampaged through Tyson's factories. In its Waterloo, Iowa facility alone, a third of the processing workers were infected and at least six died. Which brings us to the corporate play that cinched this year's sleazy for Tyson. Waterloo slaughterhouse supervisors actually knew that the back-to-work order would sicken hundreds, but not exactly how many. So, managers organized a winner-take-all betting pool on the percent of employees who would test positive. It was simply something fun, said one, kind of a morale boost. This is Jim Hightower saying the virus infected more than a third of the workers in the plant. Some fun, huh? The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday, a number of Democrats here in the Pennsylvania State House and Senate held an event calling for renewable energy here in Pennsylvania, a renewable future. They want to get to 100% renewable energy by the year 2050. And look, you know, while that's, you know, that's only, you know, a couple of years down the road, we need to do things a lot faster and a lot sooner. But this is a start, and it's something that you know, I wish we'd have started 20 years ago, so we'd be most of the way there by now. But we absolutely have to do this. And here to share some thoughts on the Go 100 PA plan, I've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Chris Rabb to come talk with us. Chris, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So walk me through this. The idea going to be we're going to get off the dirty stuff, no more burning stuff. We're going to get the renewables. 2050 is the year you've chosen to get to 100%. Is that possible?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we can do this a lot sooner if we have the political will. That's a big if in Harrisburg, right?
Right.
We have more fossil fuel lobbyists. We have more fracking proponents than we have legislators. And we're the biggest full-time legislature in the country. But, you know, it's the wild, wild west in terms of, gifts and lobbying and campaign contributions that corrupt the legislative process and our priorities for our Commonwealth. You know, we are one of only two states in the nation that has a green amendment to our Constitution that demands environmental stewardship. We had a unanimous bipartisan constitutional amendment in 1971 to enshrine into our Constitution essentially environmental stewardship. But it only exists on paper because we're one of the biggest frackers. We're the second largest producer of fracked gas, second largest producer of coal, second largest producer of nuclear energy. And we are a net exporter to other states. So we're pushing this crap all over the country when we need to be investing in renewable energy. And that renewable energy future is well within our reach and it will create good family-sustaining jobs
right.
without all of the destruction, and not just to the environment, but to the workers, right? All the people who are working in hazardous environments, whether they're explicitly hazardous or all the invisible effects on public health. So when we look at the pandemic and we say there are all these folks who are immunocompromised and it's disproportionately Black and brown who are suffering and most likely to be hospitalized if they die, it's not because Black folk are genetically different than white folk. It's that environmental racism puts pollution and all these things closest to our communities so that our systems are compromised, which makes us a bigger target for the coronavirus. So all of these things are symptoms of systems of oppression that have to be addressed. So my remarks yesterday were contextualizing this environmental push and this climate action through the lens of social justice, racial justice, immigration justice, gender justice, economic justice, worker justice. All of these things are intertwined, and you cannot put a solar roof on your home and think that this is the salvation to the problems that haunt us. It is systems of oppression that are linked to all the things that are destroying this country and this planet.
No, I don't disagree with you. Look, I was a kid who grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I suffered horribly from asthma because we were in the dirty part of town. We were
That's
on the
right.
flight path of the airplanes coming into Johns Hopkins International Airport. We were the dumping ground for a lot of things.
That's right.
So poverty
right.
plays a huge part in this. The power lines go through poor neighborhoods. You never see them
That's
going
right.
through the good addresses. So I'm 100% with you. So how do we get there? And I guess the first question I got to ask is what is the definition now of renewable energy? Because a couple of years ago, people were trying to throw frack gas into renewable. Where are we throwing this?
Right. So that's a great question, right? Because, once things catch on and they get sexy, everyone wants to get on the bandwagon and find a way to push their stuff in there. We're talking about things that are green and clean and replicable, renewable in the most basic sense. So frack gas is not one of those things because there's a limited supply of that dinosaur juice deep below the ground, right? And we are infusing a deadly cocktail of chemicals to create fractures under the ground to release that shale gas. And then once it's burning, they say, oh, it's super clean. They don't talk about the process by which it is liberated from, deep within the earth.
Right.
So it's a very specious statement. Now, there are ways to, for instance, hydrogen. So, we need to invest in hydrogen. But you need a lot of energy to produce hydrogen. And so if the source of that production of hydrogen is renewable, then that's one thing. But you can use frack gas to create hydrogen, which doesn't really help. So there's a lot of double talk and greenwashing going on by industry folks because they want to get on the bandwagon.
No, they want the bottom. This is a huge new economy.
Huge, absolutely. And they're going to try to obfuscate and confuse and distract folks. And say, oh, this is clean. Like, look at all the commercials you see with these big, huge fossil fuel companies, and they're talking about how they're saving the earth and they're using algae and all kinds of stuff. It's a shell game. But here's the thing. We can do wind. We can do solar. And you know what's going to be huge in Pennsylvania? Is geothermal. Geothermal. Under every bit of surface across the globe, not too far down, it's 54 degrees, no matter how hot or cold it is.
Yep.
Right?
No, it's one of my goals down the road.
Yeah, and what's great about it is you can use the same displaced fossil fuel workers who know about drilling to repurpose all of those orphaned and abandoned wells that there's tens of thousands of them in this state alone that could be repurposed for geothermal. So you're talking about similar equipment, similar skill sets, similar demographics in some of the most economically depressed areas of our state, particularly when the last coal mine shuts down, right? When all of these, when the fracking era ends, and it's going to end sooner than a lot of people think. Certainly, a lot of my colleagues in Harrisburg think that it's the golden goose going to keep laying these eggs, and it's not. I think Wall Street is fickle, as you know. I think they're going to turn their back on fracking, not because they're, you know, tree huggers like me, but because they see that it makes more sense to invest in renewables. And the prices, the cost of these components are going down dramatically. And we're going to get subsidies through the Biden administration, knock on wood. So then they're actually going to be competitive for the first time. But here's the last piece that's going to bring it all together, which is very exciting, which is utility scale battery storage. So we can power our grids off of huge batteries that store energy from wind and solar when the wind stops blowing and the sun stops shining at night or on a cloudy day. So we won't have the type of blackouts and brownouts we're used to. The cost of these batteries is plummeting. And once it gets to a certain point, and I forget what that number is offhand, then fracking will be dead.
Right.
I think of fracking like I think of fax machines. Do you have a fax machine, Rick?
I don't know.
Oh, of course you don't. I don't either. I don't put a fax number on my business card anymore because I don't want anyone sending me a damn fax. Faxes have banned themselves, Rick. We don't need to say we need to ban faxing because emails ban faxing, right?
Correct.
Once there was a better technology that came along that was easy to use and it was cheaper and better, nobody's talking about faxing. So we don't have, you know, I have a lot of tree huggers in my district, and I use that as a term of endearment, by the way. I don't have anyone coming to me and saying, we need to ban coal. Why? Because most folks think it is, what, obsolete.
It's dying on its own. And look,
right,
here in the Obama years, they kept saying Obama's killing coal. No,
right.
The frack gas did that, and eventually something will kill that. And hopefully we get to the place that I think both of us want to get to. Because look, you know, back in 2011, we put solar panels on our house because the state, you know, had the Sunshine Fund, which gave a little bit of incentive. The federal government had a little bit of incentive. It made it a little bit more affordable. We can bring those costs down to make it a lot more affordable, and we can make those jobs good, family-sustaining union jobs. We got an economy that can move in a good direction, in my view.
Absolutely. There is so much opportunity. It could revolutionize how we view energy, how we view economic development, and the folks who are most nervous and suspicious of, whether it's the Green New Deal, green collar jobs, renewables, whatever, they could and should be on the front lines of opportunity because there is infrastructure that can be leveraged for a renewable future, right? If you're in coal country, and you have a coal-powered plant, and it's connected to a hub, to electricity transmission.
Right, to the grid.
And that coal, that facility is down, right? And it's repurposed as geothermal. It has a solar farm. You're using the same network. You're accessing those grid points that exist in those rural areas that were coal dominated at one point. And when we need the people, we have those folks because there are going to be so many displaced workers, and they should be the first to get the new jobs for this new economy.
Clearly, because they've got the skills.
Only right.
Because they've got
absolutely
the skills.
Absolutely.
Now, here's
absolutely
my problem.
And it's not their fault
if
corporations leave them in the dust and the industry dies. That's not their fault, right? They've heated our homes and our businesses and our schools, right? They need to be protected. This is nothing against the workers, and obviously you know this, but this is something that has to be stated, particularly by Democrats, particularly by progressives. We are not in opposition to the folks who are trying to feed their families, and this was the best meaningful job they had in their area. we want to give them more opportunity.
Absolutely. No, I tell my friends in West Virginia, we can get you out of those coal mines and into something else, making renewable solar panels or wind turbines or whatever. And your standard of living would probably get better as a community because it would probably mean more jobs. But here's my problem. My problem is 2011, we went and put solar panels on our house, and this has been my experience. Our legislature let us down because they allowed the solar energy renewable energy credits to go through the floor. We're back in 2011, an SREC credit was about $250 a credit. Now it's like $8. Whole model of which that investment was built, Republicans allowed to get to destroy. And I say it was Republicans outside of Chris Ross, who was the only Republican who said, hey, we need to do something about the energy portfolio, because it was them. They're the ones who killed solar in this state. My problem is how do we build a system that doesn't get stuck in these political winds that you can have one party destroy it when they get control?
Well, that's going to change once the winds shift, right? Because think about it like this. Just think about cannabis.
Once the wind shifts.
Pun intended. Seriously, though, think about cannabis, right? Democrats are, well, more recently are for it. Republicans have been against it since really the, generation. Okay? But now they see how much money is being made and they want a piece of it. Why they want a piece of it? I mean, because it's huge. And then that includes hemp.
Yeah.
And you got states like Kentucky that are, a national leader in industrial hemp. They see dollars and cents. And pretty soon, very soon, cannabis will not be a partisan issue. And we can look at different examples where that's the case, because it's been monetized to the point where everyone can get a piece. Now, I'm not saying that is inherently good, but that is the trajectory.
That's how you see it.
For renewables. Right. And also, so I represent 65,000 people in Northwest Philly. If any of my fellow state reps anywhere in the state, if they have a new big employer in their backyard and they're creating jobs that haven't been created in generations, and it happens to be a solar business, then you better believe that conservative Republican is going to be for solar.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Right. I mean, it's just basic self-interest.
Yeah, yeah.
Basic self-interest. And that's going to happen.
No, and so legislatively, what are we doing to move something? Because obviously nothing is going to get through the House and Senate in this session,
right. Given
the makeup and the complexity of who controls what. What was the point of this press conference yesterday? And then what's the direction you want folks to go?
Sure. Well, a lot of the work we have to do in the interim is letting suspicious or wishy-washy Democrats who are not up on the science, who are not particularly well-versed in this, to understand that this is not just feasible. We have to do it.
That's imperative.
So it's imperative. And I have Democratic colleagues who are co-sponsors of my bill who don't really believe that we can get to 100% renewable, because they've been so inundated by the fossil fuel lobbyists who say, oh, this is not possible, and they're believing the naysayers, and they're really just not optimistic about what's possible. And I'm not an optimist by nature. I'm actually mildly allergic to optimism, but I believe in science. I believe in the facts, and I believe, and I'm a student of history, and I know this. I have 16 great-great-grandparents, all of whom were born into a society where slavery was the law of the land. So all of my grandparents' grandparents were Black, most of whom were enslaved from as far south as Mississippi to far north as Manhattan. All 16 of my great-great-grandparents died free. It didn't just happen. They weren't waiting for Abraham Lincoln. There were 200,000 Black folk who were part of the Civil War and the Union forces. There were abolitionists. There were folks who did everything they could every day to resist in one way or the other. And it took generations. It took generations for this type of liberation. No one thought it was possible except for the folks who said, I can't live shackled. I must be free. And it took them a long time. I don't know when we're going to have this bill enacted into law, but I do know we can't just wait. We have to keep pushing the envelope and put our flag in the sand and say, this is the right thing right now, and so that other people will catch up to us.
Yep.
Because otherwise, the folks who are afraid of change, they win, right? We have to resist. This is how all major social movements have been victorious. People have stood up against the odds and spoken truth to power and organized and informed each other and collaborated to get it done. So I am convinced that we can get it done. I can't tell you when it's going to happen, but I can tell you that more and more people are opening up to this. And a lot of folks are listening to the younger generations who say, look, we are inheriting, you know, your messed up, you know, boomers, Generation X. And we expect more of you. So I'm doing this for my kids.
Yep. No,
this for my prospective grandkids.
I tweeted this out yesterday. You know, I hope in 50 years my kids don't tweet, don't wake up today and say F Joe Manchin, because they're roasting
right
on this planet because we didn't get anything done. So I
That's
hope
right.
folks will go to the website, go100pa.com. That's the website, go100pa.com.
Yep.
We'll get links out on social media. Follow Senate Bill 872, House Bill 100. We'll make sure we get stuff out. That also the hashtag Go100PA. I'll follow that along. Chris, I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back as this continues down the path. Keep us up to the date on the new exciting developments, technologies, all that stuff to keep us on the cutting edge.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. Pennsylvania State Representative Chris Rabb. Again, check out the website, go100pa.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1910. That was the day the Protocol of Peace brought an end to the cloakmaker strike in New York City. The garment industry had been rocked by the uprising of 20,000 months earlier. Young women had struck hundreds of small shops over pay, recognition, and working conditions. They won ILGWU recognition in all but a handful of shops. 60,000 cloakmakers in the city were inspired to walk out of the sweatshops that July. The mostly male strike force demanded shorter hours and increased pay, the closed shop, and more. Union membership soared, and most of the small shops caved. The larger manufacturers would not, however, and by the end of the summer, the Protocol of Peace was negotiated. Future Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis figured prominently in the negotiations. The protocol established higher wages, shorter hours, and overtime pay. It also guaranteed the union shop, elimination of contracting, and monitoring of piecework rates. Even more significant, workers won a union health center, a board of sanitary control, a board of grievances, and a board of arbitration. For the first time, garment workers had access to health care, a way to eliminate sweatshop conditions, and a way to mediate and resolve shop floor complaints. The price to be paid, however, was that workers would give up their most powerful leveraging tool, the right to strike. The agreement was lauded as a step forward for industrial democracy. But soon, many workers complained that the protocol failed to answer a number of shop floor issues. Grievances piled up, and workers were penalized when they attempted to strike to resolve their problems. The protocol would be scrapped for a return to militant strikes during the 1920s. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across this Interesting story. Yesterday, we were talking about company towns. Amazon, and it was being floated that Amazon could create these giant company towns with, you know, with housing and, you know, low cost housing, transportation, basically recreating high density living around the warehouse so that they could get access to, you know, cheap labor and controllable labor, in my view. And it's being, you know, peddled as the future. You know, this is how we can solve our worker shortages. Not paying them decent wages with good benefits and some voice on the job and a future. No, can't have that. But by, you know, trapping them into leases and into, you know, into living in, you know, living environments. I got this article that, and thank you, Janice, for sending this. It's fantastic. Evidently, this billionaire, who I've never heard of, his name's Mark Lohr. I guess he is deciding that he's going to build a 150,000-acre new city. Going to do it within the next 40 years. Going to build this giant city with a population. He wants to have a population of something like 5 million people in the, basically in the desert. No, don't worry about how he's going to get water to all these people, all these 5 million people in this high-density living area. But he's going to build, it's going to be Telosa is the name of it. And it's going to be the future blueprint of urban living, according to the hype man. And part of me goes, I don't know, this seems like a gimmick. This seems like a nice way to, you know, get investor money to come flowing in so that you can, you know, pretend like you're moving somewhere. They're using all the right buzzwords of sustainability and equitability and human potential and, you know, all of those nice words that, you know, we care about our citizens and, you know, this is going to be an egalitarian society of sustainability and equity and all of that. They're calling it and they're saying that it could be the most sustainable city in the world. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, this sounds great. Where are people going to work? Who are they going to work for? What are they going to do? And how are you going to recruit them to come to this city? Will this be the futuristic city of, we're only inviting some people? So is this the beginning of massive segregation to where we only get people that we approve of? Basically a citywide homeowners association? I don't know, but I'm interested to see what some more of this information coming out, because again, this is just a rich guy going, hey, I'm going to decide how to change the world. And look, I'm not opposed to this. I'm really not opposed to this idea yet. I kind of like the idea of what could we do? What is possible? Now, interestingly enough, I look at somewhere like Vegas having some real problems with, you know, shortage of water seems to be a pretty big deal. They've got energy needs, real big problems there. Going to be interesting to see what they do, because this Telosa that they're proposing is going to be like 10 times as big as Vegas. I mean, we're talking a massive, massive place. And I love, you know, things, people who think big and big ideas and futuristic stuff. You know, when I was a kid, I grew up, you know, on Ray Bradbury books and Omni magazine and, you know, thinking of, you know, what could be. And I'll be honest, I'm living in a moment where, as a kid, you know, the fact that you could talk to someone on the phone and see them was like, oh my God, that's so, the fact that we walk around with something in our pockets that's more powerful, had more power computing than rooms full of servers is just incredible to me. So I'm not opposed to what we can do. My question is what's the aim and what are the goals? And again, who wins, who loses? Which side of the coin do you find yourself? But I think it's something worth looking into. It's something that I've found some interest in. And if you want to take a look at that, look up Telosa, T-E-L-O-S-A, as the name of the city that they're proposing. I'm going to spend a little time on it. Love to hear your thoughts. They're saying that they could build it beginning by 2030. So maybe that's where we retire. Yeah, there's an idea. Let's take a quick break. Right back with our good friend Bob Ney after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
You get too close to a point of no return. We don't have a lot of time. So we have to act. All of us, we have to act now.
Humanity on a catastrophic pathway, new UN report finds. Good news and bad for climate action at the UN General Assembly. Plus,
fire is not going to go away. It's going to keep burning.
Good news and bad for the world's last stand of giant sequoias.
All of that good news and bad, straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We're all tenants of planet Earth. We are definitely not getting our security deposit back.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I think I'm starting to see why people are annoyed with the United Nations. They keep putting out these reports, and they aren't good news.
No, they are not. First, the bad news. Despite new updated pledges to cut global greenhouse gas emissions under the United Nations Paris Climate Agreement, a new UN report projects the world is poised to rise a catastrophic 2.7 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. Oy. Without major action.
Oy.
That is far above the 2 degrees Celsius target that countries had agreed to. Now, this new report says that's if all of the countries meet their emissions promises that they've made so far. And under current commitments, global emissions are likely to increase by 16% by 2030. Scientists warn governments need to slash global emissions by 45% by 2030 to be on the path to reach carbon neutrality by 2050. Humanity's use of fossil fuels has already heated the planet more than 1 degree Celsius, and we're already seeing its effects in increasingly frequent extreme heat waves, droughts, fires, floods, and rising sea levels. What would a world with 2.7 degrees Celsius of warming look like? Well, here's climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann.
We don't want to find out, and that's why it's so important that, you know, we not kick the can down, you know, the road several decades. We need to make sure that we decarbonize our economy now.
Yes, we do. Again, that report from the UN is based on current pledges from countries around the world. And even with those pledges, it is not going to be enough.
The new UN report was released in conjunction with the annual meeting of world governments at the United Nations General Assembly in New York City. It also finds that wealthy nations have fallen more than $20 billion short of the $100 billion in climate aid that they promised to poorer countries that did not cause man-made climate change. And that has deepened mistrust between nations. As UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson explained at the UN,
it is the developing world that is bearing the brunt of catastrophic climate change in the form of hurricanes and fires and floods and the real long-term economic damage that they face. And yet it's the developed world that over 200 years has put the carbon in the atmosphere that is causing this acceleration of climate change. And so it really is up to us to help them.
Way to go, wealthy and developed countries. Use up all the resources and pull the ladder up after you.
And it matters because climate change is already fueling a wave of migration. A new World Bank report finds that migration is on the rise within countries in East and Central Asia, North Africa, and Eastern Europe due to climate change affecting crop yields and water availability. The researchers project that absent concerted climate and development action, more than 200 million people could be forced to migrate to escape climate change impacts within the next 30 years.
Yeah, good luck. Where are they going to go?
But President Biden, late last week, formally unveiled a new agreement with the European Union to cut global methane emissions by at least 30% by 2030. That could be big because methane, the primary ingredient in natural gas, is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide on shorter timescales. And scientists say cutting methane pollution is the single fastest, most effective strategy we have to slow the rate of warming. Finally, in California, the bad news is that the state's relentless wildfire season is second only to last year's record-setting wildfire season. Worse, the extent of this year's fires is already bigger than where we were this time last year. But the good news, in California's Sequoia National Park, thanks to aggressive firefighting and decades of intense forest management, fire crews so far have been able to defend the ancient giant trees from the massive KNP complex wildfire. And according to Sequoia National Park's chief scientist, Dr. Christy Brigham, on a recent broadcast, there is a lot that the public can do to help save this forest for future generations.
Climate change, that is at the root of this problem, and we can all take part in that solution individually and collectively.
Well, we can try. Of course, what's it say about the situation we're in where the good news is when a 3,000-year-old forest isn't burning down that bad so far? For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So evidently, the House Freedom Caucus losing their mind over the defense bill. Evidently, in the latest National Defense Authorization Act bill, Pennsylvania Representative Christy Houlihan has put in a bipartisan amendment to make it that women will be included in the draft going forward. The Freedom Caucus seems to be not on that line. You had Representative Mary Miller of Illinois say, "The Democrats and sadly some Republicans want to draft your daughters. This is wrong. It's immoral." And they're doing it anyway. I would go a different route with this. I think we draft billionaires. I don't expect Jeff Bezos to pick up a gun, but we draft his money. And we say, you know what? We're sending poor people into war. You're going to make sure that they have body armor. You billionaire over there are going to make sure that they have shoes. You're going to, and we're going to enlist them, make them feel patriotic. To me, that's the draft authorization bill I want to see. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst, Bob Nay. Bob, thanks for taking time for you.
Thank you, Rick.
So which side of this are you on? Do we draft women, equality, all of that stuff? You know, should they have to sign up for selective service at 18?
First of all, on Bezos, he's advancing the whole life extension technology, research.
Yeah, yeah.
He's there's two things you can't beat in life, and that's, taxes and death. Well, he's beaten taxes, so now he's working on death. So I don't think that he's the good example, because he would be drafted and he would pay somebody $10 million to go take his place out in the field.
No. I didn't say put him into the field. I said draft his money.
A lot of people would want him into the field. Okay.
No, I know better than that. That's never going to happen. Rich people don't die in wars.
Well, exactly. That's what I was saying. He would pay somebody to go out, for him. First of all, we don't have a active draft.
Right.
I remember when I was there, Charlie Rangel introduced a bill Rangel's theory, he always thinks outside the box. His theory was, if you're going to have a draft, then make it active, And so we had a vote. I think there was like three people that voted for it and everybody else against it. But we don't have a active draft.
Right.
So, I don't see why they're making such a big deal about it anyway. You can go ahead and include, male and female in it right now, because it's not even active. Yes, it could be activated someday. I understand that. But I just don't see why they would make this the cause of the day.
No, and it's kind of stupid that it never was If we're going to war as a country, we're all in, because there are things that even in the most sexist gender kind of defined moment in history, we still needed women in the military to do certain jobs, just like we needed men. Now, I'm not saying we're there now, but I'm saying we were at one point, and you could have had it even then.
Yeah, and I think Congresswoman Houlihan put the amendment forth, which, by the way, as it grew out of committee, it had, as you said, bipartisan support. So it's the Freedom Caucus that's honing in on it. But when she drafted it, it was to make a statement that women's roles are not less important in the military. So if she reforms the Selective Service to, include everybody, then that would send a message that women are vital, like you said, to and have been forever to the defense of the country. So it's a statement that I don't see why the Freedom Caucus focuses in on this, and it has received Republican support.
Yeah, it's just another dumb thing, and shouldn't even be something that's fought over. Like you say, it should be one of those yawn votes, Bob. This should not be something that gets it. Speaking of yawn votes. Evidently, the House passed a stopgap measure on the debt ceiling. Going to take us all the way into the future to, I think, December 3rd.
Right. I think you and I predicted that.
Yeah.
I think we did. I know we talked on your show about why doesn't this go further. But yeah, they did the short term. They're trying to lure in somebody in the Senate, to go along with it and make it short term. Oh, I know what we talked about too. You and I talked about the fact that if it gets into the election year, then they all hold hands and put it till after the election.
Right.
Neither party wants to shut down the government.
No, what's interesting is you go back to the former guy's years, the national debt during the Trump era rose $8 trillion. And we didn't hear a peep about the debt ceiling during those 4 years.
Well, also, they did the most unique thing and just said, well, we don't need to do this. And they kind of all agreed, okay, we don't need to do this right now. It's kind of automatic without a vote.
So is it
what
possible?
Is
it possible for Biden to do that? No, you know what? We're paying our bills. Sit down, shut up. We've already spent the money. We're paying the credit card bill this month.
Well, I mean, they could. And again, this has become... it's backwards, because if you're going to protest spending, do it at the point where it is spent, which is, I hate to even use this word, budget process, because we don't do budgets anymore. None of them do. They haven't for 15 years. But at the point you're doing the kick it down the road bills, continuation bills is what they really are. The point you're doing that is your point. If you're concerned about fiscal propriety, that's your point. You make your statement, not after the bills are passed, and then you pay for it with the debt ceiling. That's not the point you do this.
Right. No, so it just seems like this
that's
is
why in the past it was never a big issue.
No, because we already spent the money. It's like
it's spent.
I know Republicans always love to use kitchen table economic stuff. It's kind of like going, okay, I went out and I spent a bunch of money on my credit card, and I'm going to now argue over if I'm going to pay the bill.
Right.
It makes no sense. You pay the damn bill. You should have argued over spending it, which that's the right spot. But this is just to cause chaos. Now, I've got some folks who have reached out and said, what would happen if we decided, you know what, we're going to call Republicans bluff? Fine, you're not going to pay the bills. We're not paying the bills. What does Armageddon look like? Because we've been threatened with it for so long, I don't think anybody really knows what that would look like.
I think in general, here's what the Treasury would do. The Treasury would attempt to move or shift money to pay certain obligations, which they could do temporarily. The big ones, Social Security, obviously, Medicaid, veterans benefits. Now, of course, health care, too, because, we subsidize some health care.
Right.
So they would do that. The Treasury would, hold this, don't pay that, move this, et cetera, to be able to pay the biggies. That would only last so long, though, to where you're not going to be able to meet the obligations. Well, my opinion would happen. You wouldn't meet the obligation to pay certain things like Social Security checks, veterans benefits, and Medicaid. I mean, you could pay it for a while, and now that would happen at the cost of other items being held, you know, payments, the Interior Department, so therefore you'd close some national parks. You know, that would be the result of this. It would be a slow death with the, quote, non-essentials being shut down. You know, your Smithsonian, Library of Congress, you know, all those things eventually, when I say non-essentials, till it got to the biggies. We know what the biggies are. They're the catastrophic Social Security, Veterans Benefits, Medicaid.
Right.
You know, payments to people for human services.
But so, eventually you got to pay those back, right? Eventually, once you restart up, you got to pay them anyway. So you're causing another backlog and causing more crisis in the middle of a crisis. Politically, I don't know how this is a win for Republicans to really push this.
Well, it's not. I've watched this one with interest because, look, in the past, there's the chest thumping, the world's ending, the debt ceiling, the irresponsible people, blah, 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 and then they support it, right, on a short term. McConnell has come out in the Senate, because the House is not the problem, it's done. He's come out in the Senate and he said they're not going to go along with it. Well, at some point in time, I don't know, Senator Schumer may make a choice of, okay, we're not going to cut a deal because there's nothing to cut. We're going to throw it out there. If you Republicans want to basically shut everything down, I guess you'll do it. I think that's a bluff that McConnell doesn't want to face because, you know, right now they're not in the worst shape that they've ever been in because there's so much wrangling over the 50 votes and the $3.5 trillion, et cetera.
Right.
But I argue that if the Republicans let this debt ceiling fail in the Senate, they become the target for when everything is starting to not function. That's what I argue.
Do you think people would see it that way? Because ultimately, right now, you got Biden in the White House, you got Democrats in charge of the Senate and the House. Wouldn't the calculus go, well, the Democrats control everything. They could do something else. They could use that budget reconciliation thing. Mm-hmm. Couldn't they?
Well, it would be a short-term, I think it would be, Rick, a short-term hit for the Republicans. And a long-term, if this makes sense, a more long-term hit for the Democrats.
Yep.
And I have said this when I was in office. I would go to the Lincoln Day Republican dinners, right? And the Senate, Republican Senate, would not pass something that we passed. And I would bring up the issue, you know, you need to elect, you know, some more Republicans. They have this 60-vote cloture, you know, the nonsense they do. And you know what? It didn't work. Because the base, Republicans, just like the Democrats, turn around and say, wait a minute, the Republicans control the Senate. And they would say the same thing here. We don't care. We don't care what has to happen, what maneuvers you have to do. You're running the Senate. Don't tell me I need 10 more seats. And that's true. Each party, it kind of diminishes the base. It takes a little steam out of the base because they're not going to just accept I control the Senate, but I don't have enough votes.
Yeah, we'd really love to, but we can't.
Yeah, and they're not going to say, well, okay, Senator Manchin's an independent person. No, he's still a Democrat, and they would expect that Senator Schumer will be able to cut some type of measure with him to keep things rolling. That's the long-term effect. I think short-term effect, Republicans get hit.
Yeah, short term, but I always look, you know, evidently, uh-huh. I look long term, but you know, I think it was Ricardo who said in the long term we're all dead, in the long run we're all dead. So,
but I think it's a big deal for the Democratic side in the long run. That's why they have to get through this $3.5 trillion, which is going to become $7 trillion, and passing the infrastructure bill, and then they've made two, you know, great parts of the process, take the win.
Yep.
Get the debt ceiling, and it's a triple win.
Yep.
So, again, I've been there. It's so hard to argue with your party faithfuls that we just don't have enough seats in the Senate. You know, just give us more. They expect something to be done if you technically control the chamber.
Yep, we'll see how this plays out. I got to get your thoughts on this story that the U.S. government is still buying. I guess we're still buying drones from China. Is that true for our law enforcement and for our military purposes?
Yeah, you know, we never get it right. It's like the old stories about, you know, you donate some flags and all of a sudden you find out that the flags you donate are from China. Now, this one's a little bit more serious because what they have done is they've ordered, you know, all of these drones. and they're using them for the government and the FBI and the, you know, CIA and whoever, and they are made in China. And the big deal about that, because today one of my friends saw this story, well, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is in today's world, you can put something the size of you know, smaller than a pinhead in the device, and you can get data, especially the Secret Service, which they bought 8 drones in July. And, you know, they're obviously going to use those for, you know, White House purposes. And if they are, and there's been compromising, you know, potential parts, because we scream about the Chinese all the time, and rightfully so, then what about these parts? And what about Homeland Security using, you know, using these devices too? So I think it's a problem.
Yeah, are we ever going to learn? I mean, I saw this story and I'm going, really? No. I mean, you know, I remember being, you know, just kind of struck by the, you know, by Donald Trump allowing Huawei to get back in.
Right.
And, you know, he made a little stink about it, but ultimately, you know, they got what they wanted because they seem to always get what they want. We seem to always give to the Chinese.
Right. And, you know, we have to watch when we went, and it turned out to be a horrid event, but members wanted the ability to link antennas underground in the Capitol because their cell phones wouldn't work walking from the Capitol to go vote, which is, you know, 15 minutes over, 15 minutes back, half hour, big deal to members. And we eventually had to have the National Security Agency weigh in on it because the devices were, the technology for them were partially made outside the U.S. And it wasn't in China, but it was in Israel, in Tel Aviv. And it went to great measures to try to make sure that those parts aren't compromised. And, of course, the Israelis cooperate. In China's case, they're not going to let us into the factories, okay? They're not going to do that. They're not going to let us oversee sensitive, you know, equipment they have over there.
No, we only so, we do that.
Yeah, so here's the point, I guess. Somebody is telling me we can't make a drone here. We don't make a drone here? I mean, is that what they're actually saying, that we don't? I would think this is something that could be put together in a couple of weeks. If somebody wanted to manufacture, we buy it off of them and say, look, here's our contract. Here, we've got, you know, multimillion-dollar contracts. Make your drones. You know, come to Pennsylvania. Come to Ohio, wherever. Make your drones.
It's amazing to me. I mean, just... And this is where, you know, I come back to Biden's Build Back Better plan with the American, the Buy American provision that's in there being being so necessary. Want to get your thoughts on, evidently, there are going to be some new nuke talks with Iran going on. Who's going to be involved in this?
Well, it's going to be the world because Iran is saying, look, you know, we're going to deal with the world on this. And they're beginning to compromise and they're going to let some United Nations nuclear watchdog groups, you know, provide some monitoring on Iran nuke sites. So that's the step they've taken. And then they're, but what they're saying though is they're kind of saying, well, we're going to talk with the world now, but we're going to require a little bit higher participation by the United States, meaning, of course, you know, with the sanctions. You know, we had this one aced under President Obama. We had it aced. We had a nuke deal. It rolled back the centrifuges, that's a fact. It contained Iran's nuclear program, that's a fact. The first year of the Trump administration, he kept it because of his Secretary of State. In comes Pompeo, the right of the right of the right, and John Bolton, and everything evaporates. So you really can't blame the Iranians this time. I mean, the regime's not nice,
right.
Okay? But you can't blame them for sitting there saying, okay, we're going to restart the talks, but we're going to do it with the world and, you know, we don't want to reinvent the wheel with the United States. We got to a certain point. We want to reach that point. So you really kind of can't blame them this time for focusing the world on it. I mean, I hope it's successful. I hope they can contain Iran. They're not the type of regime that you want to have, you know, nuclear devices.
And finally, last question I got for you. Yesterday, we saw the 2-page memo of the 6-point plan. You know, for me, as I said from the beginning when I first saw it, nothing new in here. Nothing surprising in there. What for me was surprising is how it was all put together, very comprehensive and actually in writing. But I'm curious, when you saw that, what did you think?
On the 6-point plan?
Yeah.
Which one?
The one where they were going to overthrow the election, the coup plan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Which one? That has officially been the reaction of our mainstream media. Oh, yeah, which one? What are you talking about? Six-point plan.
There was a plan that Biden came out with, and he had 6 points in it. So my mind went to that, and I thought, okay, it was kind of innocuous, but, oh, yes, the great 6-point plan of Trump. It's still getting some media attention today. I mean, it's a scary thing. And I think had he exited the White House in a normal way, and if we didn't find out about all of these things, because I think in the long run, this does hurt him. But you look at these and you just wonder what we were on the brink of.
Yep.
And who devises such plans. And basically, if you read the plan, especially the one part of it, it's basically telling the vice president, here's how you can just stand there and, you know, declare this state invalid and that state invalid, which he can't do.
What's scary, though, is as I sat and I read it, and I read it in its entirety, none of those points in there were surprising. They were all trial ballooned in November and December. In fact, we'd probably talked about a number of the components. But I actually believed that people would have bought it.
You mean within the Trump administration?
No, within the with Republican voters. I think eventually the American people would have swallowed it.
I mean, you never know. I'm probably a bad one to ask about this because, you know, the process, I've been in the Electoral College, you know, when Bush was certified in 2004. It's a process. You have set rules. And so my brain says it's pretty clear. The state certified, and that's the end of the road. But I guess you're right. Some people, you know, may have believed it. I talked today on another different topic with a longtime 40-year friend of mine who's he's a Republican, very reasonable, et cetera, and he went into this whole dissertation, well, Bob, didn't you think the election was actually stolen? I do. That's what he said to me. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. He said, no, I think it was stolen. I said, based on what court filings? Well, he couldn't tell me. So I guess you make a valid point.
No, I as I looked through it, they went back to history. This is based in the Founding Fathers, the election of 1804, Jefferson Adams, which nobody remembers the history of at all. But hey, Founding Fathers, And they threw in a liberal, lawyer who's argued in front of the Supreme Court in Lawrence Tribe. They had all the bases covered where they could point and say this is constitutional. And I believe that people would have eventually, especially on the right, would have loved it. But eventually the people on the left, they'd have swallowed it.
I mean, some people may.
It's scary.
I mean, they believed, they believed he was going to be reinstituted as president twice this year.
And they still do. That's the other frightening part. But, Bob, I appreciate the time. Always great stuff, my friend.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. Our good friend Bob Ney. No, serious. I really, honestly, truthfully, hate thinking that way, that we would eventually swallow it. But I think we would. I think as a country, there would have been some spasms. But eventually. And that's what they were planning on. And had it not been for Pence, and you know, I hate saying this, but you know, Pence is going to be remembered positively in history for that moment. Just like I remember learning about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and that 1804 election. Adams is one of my favorite presidents in history for one reason. When he lost, he left. He respected the process. I mean, that's the really chilling part of that memo. Is it doesn't take into account that was the first time in the history of civilization that you had an ideological change of power without blood loss. And they were going to use that to overturn, to steal an election. I mean, that's just mind-blowing. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go. Wherever you go, and as always, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Make sure you follow us on Twitter @RickSmithShow. Like us on Facebook. Subscribe over at YouTube. Give us a thumbs up and share all that. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.